The Holy Gospel according to St. John, the first chapter.
Glory to you, O Lord.
The next day, Jesus decided to go to Galilee. He found Philip and said to him, "Follow me." Now Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him about whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus, son of Joseph from Nazareth." Nathanael said to him, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" Philip said to him, "Come and see." When Jesus saw Nathanael coming toward him, he said of him, "Here is truly an Israelite in whom there is no deceit." Nathanael asked him, "Where did you get to know me?" Jesus answered, "I saw you under the fig tree before Philip called you." Nathanael replied, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." Jesus answered, "Do you believe because I told you that I saw you under the fig tree? You will see greater things than these." And he said to him, "Very truly I tell you, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man." The Gospel of the Lord.
Praise to you, O Christ.
I want to start by pointing out that the Ohio State University football team are the college football national champions. And I will make sure that Professor Carey hears me say that later this morning as well. As people heard me rooting for Ohio State, they asked the question, "How did you get to know and to like Ohio State University?" Remembering that I attended seminary in Columbus, Ohio, which is the home of Ohio State University. And my first year in seminary, I was assigned to the Lutheran chapel at the university, and so got to know the university and many of the students. I also learned that any time that we would plan an event at the chapel, we had to have two schedules in front of us: the football schedule and the basketball schedule. And if we planned anything during any one of those games, no one would attend. But it was also during that time in seminary that I met a recent Ohio State graduate who was a classmate of mine in seminary named Bill. Bill was a trumpeter in the Ohio State University marching band, the best blank band in the land, and took such pride in being part of that organization. And so I also grew quickly to have a passion for their band and for their music program. It was one summer on summer break that I had wanted to spend some time at the beach. That when you say going to the beach in Ohio, they think you're going to the shores of Lake Erie. And I informed them that that wasn't really the beach from those of us who are closer to the East Coast. And Bill, my friend, decided to travel with me because he had never been to the beach and had never seen the ocean before. So I remember we pulled into Rehoboth Beach, and as we turned the corner, there was a parking lot, and he saw the ocean for the first time. And he literally stopped the car, opened the door, and ran to the beach. Now, part of the problem was he had not turned the car off, nor had he put it in park. And so once I got the car stopped and once I got it turned off, I started walking towards him. He came running back and he said, "You have to see this." The absolute joy he encountered in seeing the ocean for the first time inspired in him a desire to come and see. He wanted to share that with others. And I think that captures that passion in the gospel reading today of someone who has encountered the Lord. Come and see. What moved me as I watched the end of the Ohio State football game this week was what happened between the basketball phenomenon LeBron James and the quarterback of Ohio State, Cardale Jones. And LeBron James went up to Jones and gave him a hug, and he said to him, "Congratulations on the national title. You have given the state of Ohio something I haven't been able to do, a championship." And it raised up for me this question: who is the one person that we think, if we invest everything in, will make it work for us? Who is the one person, if we invest heart and soul and mind and strength in that person, will make it work? And the writer of the Gospel of John gives us the answer. The answer for the writer of the Gospel of John is that Jesus, the Son of God, is the one. In fact, if you look at the end of the Gospel, John gives you the reason for writing the Gospel. And John says, "I have written all these things, and there are many more that I haven't written, because if I did, the world could not contain the story, so that you may come to believe that Jesus is the Son of God." Jesus is the one that saves the world. The beginning of the Gospel of John mirrors the beginning of the book of Genesis with the phrase, "In the beginning." And what it captures in both places is what God has done and what God will do. And we hear in the creation account in Genesis that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. We ask the question, how did God create? And we see that God created with the power of word, that God said it and it was done. And we realize at that point that God's word has a power and an authority over human life that rewrites the entire story of creation. And that's important to realize, because early on God's people realized that if they came face to face with this ultimate power, this ultimate authority in the world, that they couldn't live, because they were never good enough to be in the presence of God. And as Pastor Tasha unpacked in such a wonderful way 2 weeks ago, so God became tabernacled in a safe place that only the one who was pure of heart could see the presence of God. And what the writer of the Gospel of John does is pick up on that notion of God being the ultimate authority that brings everything into being, that shapes creation. It says that ultimate authority has come to dwell with us, not in some overwhelming form that we can't bear to be present with, but through Jesus. And in encountering Jesus, our lives are transformed. Our story is rewritten. And as our story is rewritten by God, then the things that have power over our lives start to change. I shared with you the story of my friend Bill. He married a sweetheart that he met in seminary, and they traveled to Germany so that his wife could work on her PhD in Germany. And one day, as Bill was walking across the street with his young son in a backpack on his back, an elderly member of the community mistook the accelerator on her car for the brake and went through the intersection. And Bill's son was seriously injured, and Bill was killed. believing in Jesus tells us that Bill's life is not defined by death. Human life is not defined by the power of death, but the very power of resurrection and life. Because we have been united with Jesus in a death like his, we shall certainly be resurrected with Jesus in a resurrection like his. What unites humanity is the common ground we find in God's saving work through Jesus Christ. A colleague of one of mine used to say many times, the death rate is still one per person. It's the one thing we have in common with each other. And God, through Jesus, has changed the power of death over our lives. He is the one that transforms and saves the world. That belief in Jesus as the common ground allows then the writer of the Gospel of John to speak about unity, which is beautifully and masterfully expressed later in the Gospel in what is called the High Priestly Prayer. And one of those lines in that prayer is, God, I pray that they may be one as you and I are one, that there becomes a unity among humanity whenever Jesus is the common ground. The unity of the church is not dependent on how a building looks. It's not dependent on its worship practices. It's not dependent upon how long it's existed or what kind of music that it does. It's not dependent upon its social ministry. The unity of the church is found in a group of people who are committed to being disciples of Jesus Christ. Susan Cain wrote a book, Quiet. The subtitle is The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. And she talks about how really that power of those who are extroverted, out there, engaged, overwhelming, sometimes energetic, really dominates the way that we live life now. And she lifts up those of us, and I use the word us intentionally, who have a side that doesn't necessarily draw energy from being with people, but is a quieter side. And as she establishes her argument in the book, she makes observation that slowly we have seen a change in why we follow people. And in the early 1900s, if you look at the literature, we follow people because of their character, grounded and rooted in key values. But the transition has come to the point where now we follow people because of their personalities, dynamic, engaging, embracing those that we want to be around because we like, and it charges us up. And I think that being personality driven can stand in opposition of the unity of the church. Because the church is not about gathering around one particular person's identity and personality, but are people who follow Jesus Christ as his disciples. If the church is based on the personality of one of two things will have to happen for that pastor or leader. Either the church will have to reduce in size so that people who want to be with this dynamic character can all have that personal relationship, because once you get beyond a core size, you can't all have that relationship anymore. Or the other option to that is the person with that dynamic personality needs to put in more and more hours and work continually to keep up all of those relationships. And it ends up burning out and destroying the person if it keeps up for too long. It works against the unity of the congregation. My wife helped me learn something about myself many years ago. And that is that at the parish I served in northeastern Ohio, we had an Air Force base close by, and a number of men and women from the Air Force base were members of the congregation. And two of the men were deployed to China for a short amount of time. And when they returned from China, they brought me a gift, which were these two beautiful porcelain spheres that are hand-painted with some kind of metal that has this wonderful, beautiful ringing like bells inside, and you'd use them in your hands to bring a sense of relaxation. And they're included in this wonderful sort of silk-covered box. And I remember showing my wife this gift and just sort of being dumbfounded by the fact that they brought me this gift. And she said, "You really don't believe that people think about you when they're not actually talking to you, do you?" I said, "No, I don't. I really don't believe that people spend all of their time talking about me when I'm not with them." Perhaps it's upbringing. I don't know what it is that leads to that. But for me, it's the realization that I personally am not the solution to what's happening in your life. I'm not the one who solves the problems. The unity of God's people, the unity of the church, is that we all stand as disciples of Jesus Christ and follow Him. The wonderful Greek word, the word is diabolos. It's many times used in English as diabolical. And the literal translation is that which separates and divides. And I think it is reasonable to conclude that there is a power of separation and division that exists in our community and in our world that is at play in a very destructive way. So we ask the question, what are some of these subtle ways that we are separated and divided? And for me, I think that one of the things that actually separates us and divides us is something called empathy. It seems to be an odd claim. But empathy, rooted in the original German word from the arts community, to live into, to feel into, post-World War II started to be applied to human relationships, to live into, to feel into what someone else is feeling, to what someone else is experiencing. And usually we live into, we feel what others are feeling for people that we like, for people that we feel sorry for people for whom there is some level of attraction and connection. And so we feel that empathy for people, and when there is violence, we identify with who we personally perceive is the victim, and live into that person's sense of being a victim. I want you to think about then what that creates in our interpersonal dynamics, that if we are aligning with those whom we assume are victims, there will always be the perpetrator, there will always be the enemy, there will always be the one out there who is the threat, the one who we believe is going to destroy and undo. So empathy, while we think would lead us to be connected with one another, actually divides us because we have a hard time connecting with those that we don't like or that we find unattractive. I believe, and I expressed this on Christmas Eve, that is captured in these phrases of lives matter, and whatever you put into that phrase of lives matter, it's the concept of physics. You have matter and you have antimatter, and antimatter is always is something that is afraid, people are afraid of, because it's a threat, because it brings about destruction to that which exists and annihilates everything. That there is a belief that there are those out there that will annihilate and destroy us. And so we will not give a second look. We will not give a second chance to those who don't fall into the category of those for whom we identify. Respect, to give a second look, is the literal translation of the word. Bill Collins, in the song Both Sides of the Story, sings these words: white man turns the corner, finds himself within a different world. A ghetto kid grabs his shoulder, throws him up against the wall. He says, would you respect me if I didn't have this gun? Because without it, I don't get respect, and that's why I carry one. How do we find ourselves arming ourselves to protect ourselves from those for whom we have no empathy? Jesus' call, were we to follow him, is to see every human being as our neighbor. That's our common ground. That's our unity, whether we find the person attractive or we find them repulsive. For me, what that means then, as we see this groping divide between races in America, and it will be very much in the forefront of conversation this weekend, is that we have this habit of overlooking how common history and story has shaped how we view other people. And we must understand that the American story is narrated and shaped from a white male perspective. That it is the white male who has the entrepreneurial spirit, the white male who is the pioneer, the white male who is the explorer with the opportunities in front of him and how he will take advantage of those opportunities and succeed if it goes well and fail, but then pick himself up by the bootstraps and try once again. We must own that narrative to be true because it writes the story of who we are. There's so many things and so many challenges I personally will never face because of my skin color and my gender. But we must also be aware that an African American story in America is narrated in a different way. It's narrated by a perspective that when they came to America, they were less than human beings. Percentage-wise, less than human beings. And that became the narrative, that became the story that shaped that community and their own then practices around that community. And you must realize that that was the narrative until just about 50 years ago. It hasn't been that long. Some of you still have carpet and furniture in your house that are that old, and you won't get rid of it. So if you won't get rid of the carpet and the furniture, why will you get rid of the old mindset? is to see one another as neighbors, is to have the story told in a new way, where God is the author and giver of life. The invitation is, come and see. It's what is said in this text. We must understand that is an invitation to something new and to something good. Henry Ford was quoted as saying, whenever someone who worked for him would come to him with a problem, he would say this, "Don't bring me your problems, bring me your solutions." Have you noticed that the trend is for people to continue to talk about what is wrong? But if you compare that to the images that Martin Luther King gave in his speeches, what were they? They were visions of what can be possible with lives that are transformed. I believe it is the call of this faith community, the body of Christ, speak about what is right, speak about what is good, to speak about what is possible in the world that will continue to be divided as people center their salvation on others and talk about what is wrong. Will you invite others into that way of being with a simple three words, come and see?